The Home Show with Sinead Ryan.
With Mila.
On News Talk.
Hello and you're very welcome along to the Halloween episode of The Home Show podcast. I'm Sinead Ryan. Coming up this week, whatever happened to snapapple and turnip carving? We'll be talking about the lesser known Samhain traditions today. Dublin's Bram Stoker Festival is on this weekend. We'll be finding out what fans of the world's most famous vampire can expect. Pete the Vet will be telling us how best to protect our pets over the Halloween period. And interiors influencer Paul Kinsella on the small changes that can make a big difference in your kitchen this weekend. If you'd like to get in touch with us on the podcast, we love to hear from listeners during the week. That's an email at thehomeshow@newstalk.com, or you'll find me over on socials at Twitter and Instagram at SineadRyan100. And any of the bits you missed, of course, you can pick them up on this pod, which is available on the Newstalk app or on newstalk.com. Double trouble, toil and trouble. Yes, it's that time of year when all things spooky and scary come out to knock on our doors. But enough about election canvassers. In fact, for my part, Halloween is really getting to reread Dracula, one of the best classics ever written. I do it every year and it's absolutely fantastic. Never disappoints. And if you've only understood Dracula from the movies, you know, the remakes and all of that, well, do yourself a favour and actually give Bram Stoker's classic a go this weekend. It'll be fantastic. It's well worth it. And of course, the author was born in Ireland, so I wonder where he got all the Transylvanian inspo from. Well, maybe we'll find out from one of my guests a little bit later. Yes, we have an almost full Halloween show. A bit of crack, lots of history and a scenic route through what is the most Irish of festivals. So do stay with us for the next hour. Pour yourself of a coffee, or maybe scoop out a pumpkin, and you are very welcome along to The Home Show. Now, Halloween is almost upon us, and no doubt some of you have been carving pumpkins, getting stocked up on sweets, and sewing your costume over the last few days. But where do these traditions come from, and to what degree is there any continuity between the modern experience of Halloween, which, let's face it, is a bit American, and the original festival of Samhain? Well, Kelly Fitzgerald is the head of the School of Irish Celtic Studies and Folklore in UCD and joins me now. You're very welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Sinead.
This is a good time of year for you. Busy time, huh?
It's a very busy time of the year right now.
Lots of reading and poring over the depths of the history department.
Yes, absolutely.
Tell us, I suppose, what Samhain is, what it means and where it came from. Because I think a lot of the stuff got lost in translation over the centuries, really, didn't it?
Yes, if we think over the centuries, I suppose I always pull it back. I always ask people to look at the year in its entirety, because, of course, Samhain or Iahowan is one of the quarter days in the Irish calendar. Mm. So to really understand its importance and how it works, you have to really look at the full year. And this is the end of the year. Not only is it the end of the year, it's the end of the harvest. So if you think of it, October is Darfover, September is Manfover. So you're in the middle and the end of the harvest. Mm. And then here we are. Let us celebrate and let us prepare ourselves for a very dark and cold winter. Just to mark that occasion, it's really important.
Yeah, so it's really back to our agricultural past and that whole changing of the seasons and bringing in the harvest and preparing to bed down for winter and all that. And that, of course, then gives you ideas of the nights getting longer and the darkness and all that kind of thing. So it actually makes a whole heap of sense to do that. And I suppose with that then comes the artificial light that we try to bring to that. Now, these days we've electricity, we stick on the light and we don't know the difference. But in times gone by, that wouldn't have been the case.
No, exactly. And I think these days in the year give us time to reflect and perhaps connect back to thinking how it would have been to live in a pre-industrial time, in a very agriculturally based time. Of course, the harvest is quite physical. It's a lot of work is involved in that. And you need your time to kind of look back, pat yourself on the back, have a bit of a celebration and prepare for what is about to come ahead of you.
Indeed, indeed. Now, when it comes to how people did that, let's look first at the home the house. So was there always a tradition of going from house to house? And, you know, what was involved in that, or where did that come from?
Yeah, I suppose really when we think of Iahowan, it is the beginning of that kind of visiting season, that sense you hear so many people talking about it these days, that we have lost that sense of camaraderie and society going around in that kind of casual visiting. But we see here, this is almost the beginning of that. Because again, I know I keep on going back to the harvest, but now you have time. You have time, you don't have that kind of artificial light. And here you are spending time kind of shortening the night and the importance of that. So in some ways, so much of what we think about being so much about being Irish, that sense of storytelling, that sense of time around the hearth. Well, this is really the beginning of that season. Mm,
indeed. So the idea then, what was the kind of link between it coming from pagan or pre-Christian times and then it becoming kind of associated with All Souls Day, which is very much a Catholic or a Christian thing?
It's interesting. I suppose I always ask people to stop thinking about pagan and then Christian. If we look at belief systems now, people can have a lot of complex belief systems that they negotiate or they engage with in the world. And I can't imagine early medieval Ireland would have been any different. Christianity, of course, was very exciting. It was very new. It was like the hot cosmopolitan thing to be. But that said, particularly when we see how tied these kind of activities, these customs, these rituals are just to the changing of the seasons and to the agricultural calendar. In some ways, it's not difficult to see that they have remained a part of lives since that time.
Okay, well, the most enjoyable aspect of Halloween is possibly all the food that we get to eat around this time. And I suppose the two that have resonated, that have remained, because, you know, it wasn't all about Cadbury's all the time, was Colcannon and the Barm Brack. So tell us a little bit about the origins of both of those.
Well, it's really interesting. When we think of Colcannon, again, I think it's sometimes difficult for people to understand how important and special Colcannon would have been.
I love them both. Let's just start right there. I can have my dinner of Colcannon and then a brack afterwards. But it was deemed a treat rather than an accompaniment to your dinner.
Exactly. And let us just think about that. The thing people talk about when they talk about Colcannon is that big knob of butter on the top. Well, you're actually, think of it, you're eating your profits. So nowadays we sit around the dinner table, no one's checking how much butter you're putting on your spuds. But in an earlier time where this is your livelihood, you would not have let the children around the table or anyone around the table engage with that in that type of way. And in some ways you can see, if we do mention Cadbury, that sense of chocolate or that sense of a special treat, that has remained, definitely. Mm. And I suppose you have to think
just
back.
Just the treat was different.
Yes.
Okay,
yes,
okay.
Yes,
yeah. And of course, there was a connotation then with the Barm Brack. I remember my own mother wrapping up a ring in a little piece of greaseproof paper and a coin and popping it in. And we never knew. And we had spent ages guessing where it was and trying to cut the slice in a particular way and all that.
Well, I think it's fabulous, Sinead, that you had such a positive mother, that she only wanted you to have things that were positive in the future.
Oh, right. Were there other things that went in that didn't
there definitely make that could have been other things that could have been in the Barm Brack. And that sense, I suppose that's where you see that sense that the other world is so close to us and the gifts that the other world has are alive and more apparent in this world. And divination is one of those. And you see that in the Barm Brack. So again, the ring and the gold coin, you know, are you going to get married? Are you going to be wealthy? But then we could think of it, if you get a piece of wood resembling a coffin, you know, are you going to die this year?
Oh, right.
Is there a pea? You're going to have poverty. So again, there could be numerous kind of symbols that would represent what your future had in store for you.
Interesting. Right. Well, there's a thought now for people who want to put in a pea. Mind you, if you bit down on that, you'd lose your molar and it'd cost your fortune, so you would be in poverty. Now, turnips played a part as well. We weren't known for the old pumpkins for an awful long time.
No. And interestingly enough, now I know people can give out about the pumpkin and it's so American, But the potato is from the New World as well, so let's not forget that. But
fair.
But we do see perhaps why there is so much kind of controversy over the imported pumpkin is because there was something here already, and that, of course, is the turnip. And if you speak to anyone who has spent time trying to carve a turnip...
You wouldn't be well.
No. And you can see why the pumpkin took over. Mm. So that is what's fabulous about...
It's bigger and it's orangey and it doesn't take nearly as much time to carve out soft fruit.
And you can really get intricate the patterns and you could put the candle inside. It just takes so many
Definitely
more boxes.
Definitely more fun. All right. And then in terms of the dressing up, what was that tradition about? Was that really to ward off witches and werewolves and all that kind of thing, or was it something more playful?
Again, it's an interesting thing, and when we look at vernacular culture or folk customs, you can't give one definitive answer, and belief systems change throughout. You know, again, I think people need to remember with folk customs, Simon Harris can't step at the top of Leinster House and say, this is our belief system, right? So again, there's a bit of give and take everywhere here. But you hear examples, again, of this sense in Irish tradition, Irish legends, the kind of impact of changelings and the fear of changelings. So that could be throughout the year.
So changelings, I suppose, maybe for a younger audience, was this belief that your baby, a newborn baby, could be stolen by the fairies and something in its put in its place in its bassinet. And people genuinely feared that, like they do the banshee or, you know, the wailing woman or traditions like that.
Absolutely. And perhaps, you know, perhaps that was a way to explain the world in an earlier time for special needs or different disabilities that may have happened. Mm. But we also see then that fear is very strong. And then, of course, because Halloween is that time where this world and the other world are so close, that fear just kind of has increased itself. Mm. But that said, people are taking it and going having a little bit of fun with it as well. So it's not just kind of putting the young boy in a girl's petticoat. This is really going all out. And regardless if you're trying to ward off the spirits or not, if you are getting up to a bit of divilment, you don't want anyone to know it was you who did it.
That's true enough, of course. So the trick and the treat was like you'd be, you know, playing pranks on people, but you were dressing up to hide yourself rather than anything else. So are there any traditions, Kelly, that you feel, that would be nice to do now? Maybe something that's gone by the wayside?
It's difficult. I don't know if it's gone by the wayside, but what I do love about Halloween is that it is very much about the community. And unlike Christmas or some other holidays or days of the year, which there's a real pressure on spending money or really kind of, you know, going all out for that, what is wonderful about Halloween is that it is for everybody. And, you know, your costumes can be taken with a bit of that and a bit of this. And in these times of trying to get away from single-use plastics and different ways of commemorating or celebrating the year, you can return to kind of more natural things or found objects you find around the house. And it's more about the imagination than the money you've put into it.
Oh, yeah. And look, that is the important thing, isn't it, with all of this? You know, back to the Blue Peter and double sticky-sided tape, as far as I'm concerned. Kelly, I'm curious. You've a name, Kelly, but I'm just curious about that accent and how you ended up in the School of Irish Celtic Studies and Folklore here in UCD.
Oh, Sinead, that's a very long story, but I'm originally from Chicago, as you can tell by my accent. I've been here a long time now, but you can see that, interestingly enough, growing up in Chicago, I would go trick-or-treating. But of course, because All Souls Day is a holy day of obligation, my mother would have us come home, scrub up and go to mass after trick-or-treating so that we were done for the next day.
Oh, right. Okay. So you got the trick at the end of it and the treat before. All right. Well, Kelly Fitzgerald, thank you so much for joining us with all of those traditions. And folks, if you have a favourite tradition that you'd like, we didn't even get to the bobbing apples. I remember doing that as a kid nearly. It was like waterboarding.
It was.
If you had particularly violent siblings, it was like waterboarding, wasn't it? Tell us just about that one.
Again, I suppose it's just fantastic when you think of all the foods or what happens with that, and apples at this time of year, the abundance of apples. But but we can't just sit there and eat apples. No. And this whole dunking in and trying to get your teeth around an apple as someone is probably pushing your head down as well. It was pure torture, really.
Yeah. Oh, I recommend everybody gives it a go. Definitely. Keep the kids happy for hours. Kelly Fitzgerald, Head of School of Irish Celtic Studies and Folklore in UCD. Thanks a million for joining us. The Bram Stoker Festival has returned this bank holiday weekend, and from today until next Monday, the city will host a number of hopefully spooky and terrifying events in honour of the Dublin-born author of Dracula. Tom Lawler is the director of the Bram Stoker Festival, joins me in studio. Busy weekend for you?
Very busy weekend. Yeah, I should say I'm co-director actually. My other co-director, Maria Schwepp, is off building and producing and making events come to life today.
Yeah, it's kind of... Look, I know these weekend festivals go on for all kinds of things, book festivals and all that. It's hard to do this one at any other time of the year.
It's very strategically chosen. Yeah, it's not an accident that Halloween is coming up. The festival was started by Dublin City Council a number of years ago to celebrate the fact that Bram Stoker is an Irish author. Yeah. I think that often gets lost.
Yeah, and I think it does get lost because, you know, unlike Oscar Wilde or James Joyce, there's no statues that I'm aware of.
There's a bust in St. Anne's Church on Dawson Street.
Okay.
Where, happened a good segue for me, we have an event on this weekend that still has tickets available. Yeah, he's one of the lesser celebrated, I mean, I suppose in the last number of years, very celebrated by the festival. But he certainly, I think, up until a number of years ago, wasn't kind of part of the canon, wasn't part of the group of authors that people think of when they think of successful Irish authors.
Yeah.
Actually, he's created a character that's lived on forever and likely will. And that's not just because it's an immortal character. But I think he's, you know, the book has never gone out of print. Dracula's been immortalized in film, TV, all kinds of pop culture since publication, really.
Yeah. How much do we know about Bram Stoker? I mean, his name doesn't immediately shout Irishness.
It doesn't, no. So he was born in Clontarf, lived in Ireland until his late 20s. There's a lot known about his childhood. He was very sick as a child. He was bedbound. His mother apparently would tell him stories of the cholera epidemic in Sligo, which may have coloured and informed the kind of mind that it takes to write Dracula. But he lived all over Dublin. He was a theatre critic for a while, worked in Dublin Castle for a while, and then moved to London, where he wrote Dracula from. But there's a lot of inspiration that you can, a lot of inspirations that he took from Dublin. For instance, Marsh's Library. We know that he visited a number of times in his youth and in his 20s. It's known in the visitor book from that time that he was consulting maps of Transylvania and reading about Vlad Dracul. So there's lots of kind of, you know, there's lots of obvious things that he took from Dublin in writing that. I liked some of the lesser known things about Bram. We came across this article a few years ago, which was in a newspaper in the Times of London, where he had jumped into the Thames to save a drowning man. Now, unfortunately, the man ended up dying. But that kind of stuff, there was another article actually, which talked about how at society functions and dinners, the floor would part because he was such a good dancer and people were always hoping that Bram would ask them to dance. So those kind of human things about him.
So definitely a nicer guy than his anti-hero.
Yes. Yeah, very much so. Yeah, okay. He's very highly
regarded. Fangs weren't out for anyone. Right.
No.
Okay. Now, so tell me a little bit then about the festival and its founder and how it came about.
So, I mean, the festival this weekend, it kicked off yesterday. We've got loads going on over the weekend. One of the big things we try to do is cater for families and young people. So lots of our programme over the weekend is free. Today in St. Patrick's Park next to the cathedral is Stokerland. That's like a 3-day pop-up Victorian fun park. So there's free face painting workshops, free carousel ride, loads for children to do. That's on from 11 until 4:30. And then out in Axis Ballymun, there's a great show that I really hope your listeners will look up on our website. It's called The Haunting of Gusty Nook. We got the script a number of months ago. It's by a writer called Peter Dunn. It's a fantastic script. And it's basically, there's a young girl called Belinda who's born with the gift of being able to see ghosts and monsters. And she has to teach her super weird town how to face their fears. So it's really about telling, you know, showing kids and demonstrating that fear isn't everything and how to face it.
What do you think about this? It seems to be kind of instilled now in a lot of schools, you know, young kids. And this time of year, this week, they go in and they're all dressed up as Harry Potter and witches and all that kind of thing. And then you get kind of parents complaining, or maybe schools complaining, no, it's too scary, our children have to be minded from all that thing. I mean, like, I think I first read Dracula when I was in my teens. I mean, it scared the life out of me because it's so cleverly written, and it's not violent, you know, in the way that a lot of horror books would be now, or horror movies for sure, a lot of the stuff that's on the internet. Do you think we mind the kids too much instead of saying, look, this is okay, it's a bit of fun. You can be fearful and frightened and have fun.
Look, fear is a fact of life, right? Like fear is, you know, and people have to face their fears. I think we have to grow comfortable with being okay with the fact that we're afraid of things. I think kids in particular are actually a lot stronger than we give them credit for. And I can't cite the sources, but I can cite research that's been done over the years that shows that kids are able actually to handle, you know, handle scary things within reason. I'm not suggesting that parents go and show Poltergeist to their 5-year-old.
But like Grimm's fairy tales were a cautionary tale for, you know, the plague and flu and all that kind of thing. So
yeah, I think horror and things that contain aspects that might scare kids actually serve a purpose. And I think that purpose is to turn them into kind of well-rounded people who are able to face their fears and don't let fear kind of conquer their everyday life.
Yeah. So maybe Bram Stoker teaches us a little bit of resilience in that sense. Now, in terms of one of the things which may have been a surprise, I know it was discovered quite a while ago, there was a manuscript, a short story, which Bram Stoker wrote, that's only recently been found.
Yeah, I mean, this has been such an interesting and fascinating thing to work on this year. Brian Cleary, who's a pharmacist at the Rotunda Hospital, discovered an ad, basically, saying that there was a short story by Bram Stoker in an upcoming supplement in the Dublin Daily Express in 1890. He did a little digging, found that story in the edition a few weeks later. Had never heard it before. He's a lifelong Stoker enthusiast. He knows the anthologies. He knows all of the stories. Realized he was onto something and gathered some people basically to be able to bring this story to the world. So he got in touch with the festival. We were delighted to come on board and help bring it to a global audience. It's been verified that it has been completely undocumented anywhere else for 130 years. And news broke last weekend in the New York Times, the Guardian, the BBC, and the Irish Times. And interest in it has just sustained and grown since then. I mean, it's all over the world. It's been a really extraordinary thing to be part of. And also just to be, you know, today Eileen Walsh will read the story to people in the pillar room of the Rotunda Hospital. The room of people there will be the first to hear the story in 130 years.
Wow.
So it's quite magnificent.
Can you reveal if it's a ghost story?
It is a ghost story.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, and it's clear that there is some kind of, just in its structure and in the kind of characters within the story, it's clear that that kind of style, that sort of genre was very much on Bram's mind at the time. And Paul Murray, who's kind of Stoker's leading biographer, suggests that actually in terms of the time that it would have been written, early thinking and early planning around Dracula was already underway.
So it's called Gibbet Hill.
Gibbet Hill.
And it is published by the Rotunda Foundation.
Yes.
And it will be out now, or is out now maybe?
Out today.
Great,
yeah. And
fantastic.
And pre-order is available from there. And all funds from that book will go towards research around deafness in newborns. It's part of the Charlotte Stoker Fund, which is named for Bram's mother, who was an early advocate for the education of deaf children. So it's a really great book with a really great cause.
And a great way to support it and find out something new about Bram Stoker. Now, there's cinemas getting on board, the Lighthouse, the IFI, there's lots of Frank and Max Stein's Monster Laboratory. I don't know how authentic that is. But there's lots and lots of stuff on. Where can people find out more about this, Tom?
Head to bramstokerfestival.com. All tickets available via there and all information there.
Okay, and a lot of these, I know some of them will be sold out by now because a lot of them are free and they're always good fun around this time of year. But you would say lots still available.
Lots still available, and always check the website. People return tickets all the time, so your chances could be, you could be in luck.
Fantastic. All right, well, Tom Lawler, co-director of the Bram Stoker Festival. Enjoy the rest of the weekend.
Thank you
for dropping back in. Don't forget to pick up your tricks and treats.
Thanks very much.
And enjoy it. And to everybody who wants to go along, it's always a great old crack. And do give Dracula an actual read. It'll only take you a couple of days, and it's a cracking yarn. Tom, thanks a million.
Thank you.
Now, having been woken up by bangers and fireworks in the last week, I can sympathise with anyone who doesn't find every aspect of Halloween particularly enjoyable. But it's doubly the case for some of our pets, who can find the whole experience disorienting and terrifying. So what can we do to help them through it? Well, who best to ask than Pete the Vet, Pete Wedderburn, Chair of the ISPCA. Well done. Congratulations. There's a promotion.
Well, ISPCA is a great organisation. I've always been very fond of it. It's aiming to change the culture of Ireland to make us even more animal friendly and to make the country a better place for animals. So I'm delighted to be chair of the board of directors now, and we're going to see what we can do to bring it on to the next level. It does things like a national animal cruelty helpline, which can call if they come across any incident involving an animal that concerns them. That's the kind of thing the ISPCA does, and it has a team of inspectors. There's 9 inspectors who go out to cases of suspected cruelty, and they take prosecutions where needed, and they rescue the animals that are in trouble. So as far as I'm concerned, it's all great work, and I'm delighted to be so involved.
Good, and I'm sure they're delighted to have you. Now, look, Pete, it's supposed to be a scary time of year for all of us, but it can be particularly so for family pets, of course, who you can't explain what's going on.
There's 2 issues for pets. First thing is they don't understand. At least if a child gets frightened, you can say to them, listen, it's okay, it's fireworks because, you know, it's Halloween and it's a bit of fun, and they can settle down. You can't explain to animals, so they have this lack of understanding, which adds to their fear. But as well as that, their sense of hearing is way more sensitive than ours. So what sounds like a loud crash to us will physically hurt their ears because it's so deafening.
Yeah, of course, because they're so sensitive. Mm. So even the bangers going off, which I hate myself, can obviously be very frightening. What behaviours can they exhibit? I mean, you know, do they cower? Do they bark?
Well, I think it starts off with just getting generally agitated. So that would mean dogs barking, maybe dogs jumping out of the bed and running around the room a bit. But what happens is it kind of develops into a type of hysteria where they're almost like upset at being upset. They go from peak to peak to peak of extreme anxiety. They start to do things like trying to get into cupboards to get away from the noise. And then when they get into the cupboard, they're bumping into plates and cups, and there's crashing noises around them, and it just gets worse and worse and worse for them. Now, most animals aren't that bad. For most animals, it's just they get upset. But for some, they get just desperately upset. And so it's important for all animals, but it's absolutely crucial for the small number that gets so devastated by this.
Yeah, and sure, look, it's been going on the last week at the very least, and will continue. So, you know, it's a long period of time. It's not just the one day.
Yeah.
So keeping them in on the night, on Thursday night, is obviously going to be key. But even if you do, they can still get scared because they're hearing all this stuff.
Yeah.
So what can we do to help them?
Well, first of all, you should create a den for them. And the classic example would be maybe a boiler room or maybe a cupboard under the stairs, somewhere that's warm and cosy, somewhere you can screen off windows with curtains and blinds. You can put a loud radio on or a smart speaker these days. You can get dog-friendly YouTube stations, Spotify stations, playing music, and the music will obscure the sound
what
of fireworks.
What music do dogs like? Or is it breed specific?
I'm sure somebody's made it breed specific, even if it isn't.
Wagner for the wolves Mozart for the mongrels.
I think it's a very personal taste.
Maybe the taste of the parents. Okay, so keep them indoors, you know, keep them in so that they feel they're in a kind of a sanctuary.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And you can buy plug-in diffusers that emit pheromones that make dogs feel calmer and more relaxed. And then you can get other plug-in diffusers that emit herbal vapours of the likes of valerian, and they've been chosen to make dogs feel a little bit more
chilled. Zone out a bit.
So these things help. Also, for extreme cases, do talk to your vet about getting some type of prescription medicine to make them physically feel less anxious.
Okay.
And also for the ones that are, you know, extremely anxious, medication to actually help them be a little bit sleepy so they're just not so bothered by it at all.
Okay.
And that would really just be for the peak times.
Right. Can humans take that? I'm just asking for a friend. No, I'm only joking.
But it's in long term, what you should really be doing is desensitizing your pet to fireworks noises. You do that by downloading soundtracks of fireworks noises.
Oh.
And what you do is way early in the year, like about February, March, April, May, something like that, playing these sounds in the background on your sound system.
Like at a low volume?
Very low volume.
Okay.
And then maybe increasing the volume a bit. So then your pet will get used to the idea of these sounds as being part of the normal audio okay. terrain.
Oh, I know, but their owner might go around the bend, so that's not helpful. Now, there's a lot of treats around on Halloween, sweets and chocolate and nuts and all that. They're all a no-no now for dogs and cats, aren't they?
I think so. If you want to give your dog treats, get them some proper dog treats, do you know? They're better for them. The other ones, there's all sorts of possible complications. One of the common complications people wouldn't know about is that artificial sweetener, xylitol, is actually highly toxic to dogs. So if a dog grabs and eats a tube of chewing gum, what that chemical does is it pushes down their blood glucose down to below normal, so they actually collapse. And it's very dangerous.
Okay.
So, you know, artificial sweetness, dangerous to dogs, just don't do it.
Okay, keep all the bags out of the way.
One other thing to say about Halloween is make sure that your dog has an ID tag around its neck and that your dog or cat is microchipped, because the day after Halloween, we see more lost dogs than ever.
Because they've escaped. They've tried to get away.
Because if they do happen to get outside, they bolt and they run. Because they're so frightened. And then they run so far, they actually get lost.
Okay.
And genuinely lost. And so having them identified is really important.
That's such a good tip. Okay. Well, Pete, before I let you go, then you can settle a question for me, because dressing up is synonymous with Halloween. And we'll see all the kids dressing up in different costumes. Is there ever a need for a dog to wear a fur coat on top of the one they already says? Because it strikes me we are anthropomorphizing our animals at the moment. I have seen Burberry coats. Yeah. I've seen four little welly boots.
Well, do you know, there is
don't disappoint
a place.
Me now, Pete.
No, there is a place. I have a little dog, Kiko. Now, in the morning time, she goes out for a walk, but she doesn't always go out for a walk. What she'll do is she'll walk the back door, she'll look outside, and she'll survey the weather, and she will decide to go forwards or back to her bed, depending
on
where.
I'm with Kiko.
If she has a little coat on, she's far more likely to go forwards.
See, the bribery. Right, okay. Appealing to the whole audience there, Pete. Well
that
done.
That doesn't mean dress your pets up at Halloween. That's a little bit of craziness. You just need to remember that it's a bit of craziness. As long as your animal isn't upset by it, well, okay. But then don't do it for them. You're doing it for your own entertainment. Just be honest.
Oh, controversial. Right. On that note, Pete Wedderburn, Pete the Vet, thank you very much for that. And you can find all about Pete and Kiko's adventures on his Instagram profile, which is Pete the Vet, isn't it?
It's Pete Wedderburn.
Pete Wedderburn. Okay.
That's it.
Now, of course, it is a bank holiday, and that means a little bit extra time maybe to get some DIY done around the house. But we want it to be beautiful and inspiring. No unclogging the drains on this show, right? The nice stuff is what we're looking at here. So who better to ask than the self-styled DIY housewife of Drumcondra, Paul Kinsella, to take us back into his soul kitchen. Paul, you're very welcome back to the show. Now, look, I think the kitchen can be one of the easiest rooms to change up.
Yeah, and with the minimal amount of effort.
Yeah.
Once you have your kitchen done, you can do really small things to make a big impact.
Yeah.
Like one of the things I recently did was I changed handles. And I know I think we've spoken about how the big impact of changing handles.
I've done it myself. It transforms the look of the kitchen.
Totally, totally. And I transformed it from they were white porcelain handles that they were there when we got it done into brass. Brass is having a trending moment at the minute. So it was a cheap way to update the kitchen without going to massive expense.
Now, you do have to watch one thing, don't you? Because if you're changing like something that had two holes in the thing and now you've got a little knob.
Yes. So you have to be clever at what you're doing. Thankfully, in my kitchen, it was all just the knob pull in the handles rather than a full bar handle. If you are going to change it and extend it, you need to make sure that you have a good drill for yourself. And then if you are changing from two to one, you want to make sure that you have some wood filler and especially the paint of the kitchen.
Paint, yeah. Or just go for the same, measure it and go for the same, just in a different style or colour or whatever. Okay, and it really is. Where do we get, though? I've seen them out in IKEA.
Yeah. So IKEA is great for a certain style. You can get them off Amazon. I've actually found them in HomeSense as well. So if you're doing a project, HomeSense have beautiful little pieces that would be unique because they don't have a huge amount of stock. So you can be lucky. You can have enough just for your kitchen or maybe one or two units in your kitchen. And another good store I found is Butler & Dunn. It's in Stephen's Green Shopping Centre.
Right.
They do lovely little marble ones.
Okay, so lots of ideas there, and it really is. You can nearly change the era of your kitchen.
Totally. By just changing the handle. Yeah, 100%.
Okay. Now, of course, if you're going to do that, then you'll look at it and you'll go, oh, that needs a repaint.
Depending. If you want to repaint, I mean, I've done it myself. It's a big job, so you have to be ready for it. I recently painted my best friend's kitchen. It was a beautiful, solid wood kitchen. 58 drawers, so it was no mean feat.
What? Good friend.
I'm a very good friend, best friend, shall I say. So that was a very large kitchen, and what we had to do was we had to divide the workload over 2 weekends, because you're not going to get it done all in 1 weekend. I focused on the first weekend doing prep, so all the preparation work.
Now, what's that? Because that is probably the most important bit.
It's the most important, and I've learned myself, by skipping it, you're doing yourself a disservice. So the preparation work is the most important. So what you will start with is by degreasing all of the units and a good scrub. And I'd use usually a sugar soap. Now, you can find that in most local hardware stores, Woody's. And then you'll go in with a light sand to kind of break the surface a little bit. I am a big fan of Colour Trend as a brand. Mm. So Prime 2 for me is the most universal primer. And what I would do with the primer is, if you're going for a darker colour and you're going from wood, I'd get it tinted nearly to the colour so that you're not having to do loads of coats. Yeah. It's a really good tip to do. And Prime 2 can also be used on tile, if you fancy a little tile backsplash update. So your process when you're primer, so we've cleaned it, we've sanded it down, we're going to prime it. We will sand again and prime again, because it's really important to sand in between priming.
Oh, right.
I know.
It's a lot of work. And come here to me, Paul. Do you have to take all the presses off, the doors off, to do that?
Depends on what you fancy. I am a bit OCD in my process, so I like
to do it.
You have
to go around the edges.
You have to go around the edges. So I take all the doors off.
Okay.
And I do just the surround and the front, anything that someone can see.
Yeah.
That's what I paint.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Good tip there. Now, the tiles, you mentioned the tiles there. Mm-hmm. I'm a massive fan of the old decal tiles.
Yes.
I've put them up and I swear nobody knows they're not tiles.
No.
Nobody. Yeah. You literally have to put your hand on it. And even then you're not terribly sure. But painting tiles, I've never done that successfully. So where am I going wrong with that?
So I suppose it's, again, back to the primer.
Yeah.
Prime 2 is an epoxy-based primer, which means it's basically...
glues the paint.
It's eerie. Right. Like, you can't do any damage to it. You have to be careful with some primers because they have a heat level. So when you have a heat level, it can bubble. And that's what we don't want. Prime 2 is the one that we want.
Okay, Prime 2. And you can get that. And do you know what? There's great advice in the paint shops. You
can
go to Pat MacDonald Paints or anywhere like
Absolutely.
That. And they just say, here's what you need. Yeah. What are you trying to do? Here's what will go with whatever and all of that.
Yeah.
The backsplash. So this is the bit at the back of the counter where your sink and everything is. What do you recommend for there now?
So traditionally people tile it. But if you've moved into a new build, sometimes it's just left plaster wall. And what you can actually get, back to your point of decals, you can actually get like a decal tile wallpaper that will sit on it and look like a subway tile or a herringbone tile.
Yeah, and actually in some cases it is a tile.
Yeah.
They're like these little mosaic tiles.
Yeah, they're little mosaic tiles. So I actually did it on the floor in our garage. There's these mosaic tiles that you can buy. Now, they're very durable vinyl and they just stick on. So there's no need for
adhesive
or grout.
And they come like in blocks.
They come in packs of usually 10. I got mine in Woody's, and a pack of 10 does about a 10 square metre surface, usually around €20. So I used 3.5 packs.
I mean, that's for
floor.
Nothing. That's fantastic. Yeah. Now, how do you prep that again? Are we just cleaning it down?
Clean the floor. This is beginner DIY.
Okay.
You literally just have to make sure the surface is clean. If there's any bumps on it, I'd give it a little sand.
Yeah.
And then it's a peel and stick job. It's so easy.
Wow.
So easy to cut as well. All you need is a Stanley blade and a ruler.
I mean, you really get a completely new look.
So new. And what I'll do is I'll share what the floor I put down, very similar to, you can use them as a backsplash.
Yeah.
In my garage, it lifted it completely.
Brilliant. And that's on your Instagram, which is life at number two.
That's
Isn't
me.
That it? Life at number two. All right. Great tips there. You do actually make it sound easily. Your voice is, oh yeah, no, it's all mellow. And look, I fish into people, cutting their fingers off with the Stanley knife and gluing themselves to the door.
I mean, I have glued my fingers together before, right, but you learn.
All right. Okay. You make it sound easy. Right. Okay. Well, folks, if that is you and you would like to give it a go, then this weekend is bank holiday. Why not? Paul, thanks a million for joining us. So Life Number Two is Paul's. And I know we got a lot of queries the last time Paul was on looking for that handle. So lots of tips on that. And that is all we have time for on the show this week. We have... not quite total gone Halloween, but nearly there. I presume you've all the...
Of course I have. I have a pumpkin patch out the front.
I don't doubt it. Yeah. I don't doubt it. All right. And that's all we have time for this week on our Halloween, our spooky show. And listen, if you enjoyed it, please tell your friends, like and subscribe on the podcast. We love people, new listeners coming to the show with new ideas. And if you have an idea of a guest you'd like us to have on or a topic you'd like us to cover that you're interested in, we can hear from you during the week at email at thehomeshow@newstalk.com, or you can DM me on socials at SineadRyan100. You'll find me around there. Thanks to producer Aidan McKelvey, researcher Rory Galvin, and Stephen McClune was on sound. We will do it all next weekend. Have a wonderful Halloween. Don't do anything I wouldn't do, and we'll see you all again next time.
The Home Show with Sinead Ryan.
With Mila.
Saturday morning at 8 on News Talk.